Topic number two. For nearly 2 years, beginning early in 1978, Russia's policies were controlled by the peace faction in the Kremlin, the White Doves. Meanwhile, their Bolshevik enemies here in the United States have continued their relentless drive for war. As a result, the policies of the Kremlin peace faction have now been abandoned. Recent events in both the United States and Russia have brought about this change. My friends, you will not be able to understand events in the days to come if you do not understand the recent Kremlin takeover by the hardliners. And to understand that, you need to remember the background of events which have led up to this point during the past several years. I first began discussing the new rulers of Russia in audio letter number 28 for November 1977. Later on, I revealed much more about them in audio letter 38, which was a special issue dealing entirely with Russia. Russia's new rulers struggled for 6 decades to overthrow the Bolsheviks, and through this long and bitter struggle, the secret Kremlin Christians came to know the disease of Bolshevism more intimately than anyone else on earth. As I revealed also in audio letter 38, they are embarked on what they consider a holy war to wipe out Bolshevism from the face of the earth. So long as it still survives anywhere in the world, they are convinced that both Russia and Christianity itself will be in mortal danger. Even so, there have always been 2 factions within the secret sect of Kremlin Christians on the issue of nuclear war. They all agree that nuclear war would be horrendous, but they disagree on whether it can be avoided. The minority faction, the White Doves, believe it is possible to avoid nuclear war, but the majority, the hardliners, believe otherwise. They are convinced that no matter how many times nuclear war may be delayed, their Bolshevik enemies will eventually bring it about. And so they insist that the only realistic thing to do is to make sure Russia will win the war when it comes, with as few casualties as possible. The secret Kremlin Christians first began to outweigh the Bolsheviks in power when Joseph Stalin died in 1953. From that time until early 1978, the hardliners were in power, and they were anxious to speed the day when Russia would break free, not only from the Bolsheviks in Russia, but also from the Rockefeller cartel. In the summer of 1976, Russia began preparing for a limited nuclear Pearl Harbor attack against the United States, Great Britain, and other countries. It was the underwater missile crisis of 1976, which I revealed in audio letters 14 through 16. It was a desperate situation, as my longtime listeners will recall. And yet, the strategy of Admiral Gorshkov, the head of the Russian Navy, was one of limited war. If his naval strategy had worked, the initial attack on strategic coastal targets would have made further warfare useless. As I outline in audio letter 18, the world's ICBMs and other nuclear weapons would never have been used. But the limited public exposure of the underwater missile crisis through my audio letters had its consequences in the Kremlin. The Russians lost the critical element of surprise. And so the White Doves argued that the result of the hardliners' gamble could easily have been not limited war, but total war. They insisted that Russia must never again try to deliberately trigger nuclear war. From then on, the influence of the White Doves grew steadily, but the hardliners, headed by the original Leonid Brezhnev, stayed in the driver's seat until the end of 1977. It was the hardliners who presided over Russia's lightning-fast deployment of her secret new space triad of weapons during late 1977. I reported the deployment as it took place in audio letters 26 through 29. All three legs of the space triad are built around particle beam weapons. Up to now, Russia is still the only nation to deploy particle beams as operational weapons. The first leg of Russia's space triad are the Cosmos Interceptors. These are man-killer satellites armed with particle beams. I first reported that they were operational in September 1977. They began destroying America's fleet of spy satellites. An especially equipped Cosmos Interceptor, Cosmos 954, fought history's first true space battle, the Battle of the Harvest Moon, September 27, 1977. Firing a special neutron particle beam, Cosmos 954 knocked out America's secret military base on the moon. The Russians then quickly deployed their own military bases on the moon, and these constitute the second leg of the space triad. Today, Russian particle beam weapons are located in seven places on the near side of the moon. They can strike any visible spot on Earth less than 2 seconds after pulling the trigger, and they can deliver a blast of devastating force, as proven in the test firing of November 19, 1977, which I reported in Audio Letter 29 the following month. In Audio Letter 29, I also reported the beginning of Russia's deployment of the third leg of her space triad. These are the Cosmospheres, electrogravitic weapon platforms which can hover over any spot on Earth. They can operate at altitudes from ground level to about 800 miles and are armed with charged particle beams. The first few Cosmospheres to be deployed over the United States were used in an effort at intimidation. In late December 1977, they began firing their beam weapons into the atmosphere off the East Coast in a defocused mode. The result were the mysterious giant air booms, which came rumbling in from the Atlantic Ocean to rattle and shake thousands of homes. Government and other spokesmen put out all kinds of stories to try to explain away the booms. One of the favorites was based on the Concorde supersonic transport. Somehow, we were told, the shock waves must be racing far ahead of the plane and causing the booms. Can you imagine? As I told you at the time, explanations like that were just ridiculous cover stories and lies. And recently, a scientific study at Cornell University, headed by Professor A.R. George, proved exactly what I told you 2 years ago. That is, a freak shockwave racing ahead of the Concorde could not have produced those bone-rattling booms. But 2 years ago, the stories served their purpose. People swallowed them and calmed down. With the deployment of the secret Russian space triad during the closing days of 1977, the Russians were acting more aggressive by the day. But the number one hardliner in the Kremlin then was Leonid Brezhnev, and his health was failing. He died on January 7, 1978, as I revealed in Audio Letter 33. I also revealed that the new number one man in the Kremlin was then Marshal Dmitry Ustinov, the defense minister. Ustinov was the leader of the White Doves, the peace faction. And from then on, the Kremlin concentrated on preventing nuclear war by using SALT II to begin disarming their Bolshevik enemies here in America. After they deployed the Robotoids last spring, they almost succeeded with SALT II. But during the past few months, they have been dealt one reversal after another by the Bolsheviks. And with the synthetics now entering the picture, heated debate broke out in the Kremlin early last October between the White Doves and the Hardliners. Then tragedy struck in late October 1979. Suddenly, the men who had been ruling Russia since early 1978 began dying of poison. These included Marshal Ustinov, Leonid Brezhnev No. 2, the ceremonial double for the late real Brezhnev, Chief of Staff Nikolai Ogarkov, and a number of others. Since then, they have all been replaced by Robotoids. The men who died were members of the peace faction. They had accepted the fact that their mandate to govern was at an end. The new ruling group in Russia today are the hardliners, and their leader is Admiral Sergei Gorshkov. Topic number 3. The final legacy of the White Doves was their plan to use the Shah of Iran to unravel the Iranian crisis. The new hardliners followed through with that plan out of reverence for their fallen friends. But when the Bolsheviks assassinated the Shah on December 2nd, they were ready to shift very quickly to more aggressive policies. The pace of events since then has been speeding up fast. On December 12, NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels agreed to the new American plan for nuclear missiles to be aimed at Russia. Immediately, the Kremlin totally withdrew all offers for negotiating arms control agreements in Europe. The Russians declared that NATO had destroyed the basis for negotiations. The Russians had also learned that the Bolsheviks in the United States were preparing to seize the Iranian oil fields, using the American hostages as an excuse. Russia prepared to move into Afghanistan. On December 27, 1979, a pro-Russian coup in Kabul brought the new regime of Babrak Karmal to power. And within days, tens of thousands of Russian troops were pouring into Afghanistan. It was a classic case of chess playing by Russia's rulers. When an expert chess player makes a move, he always does so in anticipation of other moves to come. He evaluates the moves which his opponent will be forced to make in retaliation and has already planned how he will respond to those. Whenever possible, he tries to provoke moves by his opponent which will work to his own advantage. And so it was in Afghanistan. First, the Bolsheviks were deliberately provoking Russia by means of large-scale insurgent operations in Afghanistan. These were supported by at least 18 separate rebel bases in neighboring Pakistan and involved Bolshevik CIA operatives and Chinese agents there. Afghan insurgents had already taken control of two-thirds of the country, and operations were also underway to stir up Muslim unrest in the whole region. Since Russia has 40 million Muslims of her own, these actions were bound to draw a response from Russia. The Bolsheviks here in America were fostering these operations in order to lure Russia into aggressive-looking behavior near Iran. Their plan, as I revealed in AUDIO LETTER 37, is, quote, "Incidents and clashes will condition the American public to the increasingly aggressive behavior of Russia," unquote. But, my friends, the Russians know that is the Bolshevik war plan. So they have looked one step beyond the Bolsheviks, and they are letting the Bolsheviks of America walk right into a military trap. In AUDIO LETTER 37, I explained the plan for an American nuclear first strike against Russia. Its basic objective is to destroy the ground bases in Russia for her awesome space triad. There are 6 targets in this plan. 4 are rocket bases called cosmodromes. The other 2 are the cosmosphere installations in south-central Siberia. The plan calls for the targets to be attacked by American secret weapons, which I described in AUDIO LETTER 37. The 4 cosmodromes are to be attacked from bases in northern Norway and the Caspian Sea coast of Iran. Hybrid machines called submersible aircraft or subcraft are to be used. As for the cosmosphere installations in central Siberia, the original plan was to use Sinkiang Province in western China as the base. In AUDIO LETTER 52, I stated that Sinkiang Province is not available. But early this month, on January 4, a synthetic double for Defense Secretary Harold Brown went to China to try to change that. The Bolsheviks want to use Sinkiang Province to launch high-speed, pilotless aircraft called RPVs into Russia. After Russia took action in Afghanistan, the Bolsheviks here in the United States began whipping up war fever quickly. On January 4, the Carter Synthetic then in the White House spoke on television about American retaliation for Russia's intrusion into Afghanistan, calling Russia's rulers a, quote, atheistic government, unquote. The Carter Synthetic fired a series of broadsides. Invoking the old Bolshevik weapon of hunger, he embargoed 17 million tons of grain from going to Russia. To dramatize the crisis in a universal way, he threatened to pull the United States out of the Summer Olympics in Moscow. And to further kill hopes for peace, he suspended consideration of SALT II. In the days that followed, we began hearing more and more about the alleged threat to Iran from Russia. And within the past week or so, the message suddenly started getting through to people. Everywhere I go, I hear people talking about the threat of war. And the threat is real, my friends. Several days ago, the military preparations for conflict shifted into high gear. Many reservists are being called up all over the United States without a word about it in the news. On January 12, the Kremlin issued a statement in the name of Leonid Brezhnev denouncing the Carter administration. It spoke of the United States as having become, quote, an absolutely unreliable partner in international ties, unquote. It said the United States was, quote, sending to the shores of Iran a naval armada armed with atomic weapons and including a considerable part of the United States carrier force, unquote. And, quote, if there were no Afghanistan, certain circles in the United States, in NATO, would surely have found another pretext to aggravate the situation in the world, unquote. As the supposed Brezhnev statement was issued, two American carrier task forces were in the Arabian Sea near Iran, built around the Midway and the Kitty Hawk. 2 days later, a third powerful carrier group arrived. It includes America's newest and biggest carrier, the nuclear-powered Nimitz, as well as the nuclear-powered cruisers California and Texas. On January 17, the Russian Navy began deploying fast toward the Indian Ocean. A late-model Kara-class cruiser and four other ships were spotted sailing south through the Japan Sea that morning. By the following day, January 18, there were over 180 Russian submarines on the way, and still more were being ordered to join them. And at the same time, submarines were swarming into position around the United States, armed with neutron missiles. Meanwhile, a State Department spokesman helped heat up the crisis atmosphere. He said, quote, our commitment to Iran's territorial integrity stands despite their violation of international law, represented by their continued holding of our people, unquote. The same evening, just last Friday, some television news programs tossed in items to say any conflict over Iran could quickly lead to a nuclear war. And as these events were unfolding, Russian cosmospheres were forming up over the crisis area. By early Friday evening, there were 144 cosmospheres on alert, hovering over the Arabian Sea and adjacent land areas from Saudi Arabia to southern India. Last Saturday, January 19, Robotoid Ambassador Thomas Watson returned to Moscow after weeks of absence. When he arrived at the airport, he said, quote, there's no doubt but what we are in a very serious situation, unquote. And as he spoke of hopes for goodwill and effort on both sides, echoes of Pearl Harbor were in the making. In Audio Letter 34, I described how Japan was lured into making an attack on Pearl Harbor. First, Japanese anger at the United States had been stirred up by a variety of boycott techniques. Then our fleet at Pearl Harbor was held out as an enticing target. Most of our Pacific fleet were conveniently bottled up in the harbor, and they sat peacefully at anchor, unable to respond quickly in an emergency. But our three aircraft carriers had been pulled away to safety because they were indispensable to the plans for counterattack against Japan. Today, it is four decades later, and we live in a new era of weaponry. So now, it is the aircraft carriers themselves which have been demoted to the status of bait in a war trap. As of my latest report yesterday evening, all three American aircraft carriers near Iran are sitting at anchor. All are near the entrance to the Persian Gulf, along the coast of Oman. The Midway and Kitty Hawk are resting at opposite ends of the island of Mazira. And the big prize, the Nimitz, is about 25 miles southeast of the capital, Muscat. American statements have been designed to fuel Russian suspicions of an American military strike into Iran. This is intended to draw Russia's navy into the region in order to counter the United States military buildup there. And by ordering the carriers to sit at anchor, the Bolsheviks and the United States military establishment hope to provoke the Russians into an attack. But it is all a gigantic diversionary action. The purpose is to distract the Russians from the real preparations for a nuclear first strike against Russia. These preparations are the ones I warned about in Audio Letter 37. When American military sources detected Russia's massive naval deployment beginning January 17, it indicated that the plan was working. By the following day, the Bolsheviks were sure. The Russian Navy was converging toward the Arabian Sea with breakneck speed. At that point, the real action got underway. In the Caspian Sea and off northern Norway, the subcraft with Israeli pilots were on their way. They were traveling underwater on the first legs of their attack missions. By late Saturday night, 2 nights ago, the number of Russian naval vessels in the Arabian Sea was approaching 400. The majority of these were submarines of all types. And as anticipated, the Russian fleet was fanning out into a band stretching from Saudi Arabia to India. The Russians were sealing off the southern portion of the Arabian Sea. As a result, American naval forces in the area, including the three aircraft carriers, are trapped. They are bottled up and hopelessly outnumbered. But all of this was exactly as expected by the American Bolsheviks. And so, late Saturday night, Washington time, a coded signal was flashed to the subcraft to continue as planned. By that time, the northern contingent of subcraft were in the White Sea. The southern contingent had reached the north end of the Caspian Sea. It was already daylight, Sunday morning the 20th, for the subcraft contingents. Their orders were to wait out the day underwater, out of sight. Then, after nightfall, they were to continue their steady approach to get close to their targets. The subcraft were maintaining strict radio silence. They were also deep enough underwater to be invisible from the air to either the eye or radar. Yet they were also hugging the shorelines in water too shallow for Russian sonar to pick them up. And their infrared signatures were negligible as a result of extensive development. In short, by the standards of Western technology, they were undetectable. But in Audio Letter 42, I revealed Russia's master secret weapon. It is called psychoenergetic range finding, or PRF. It is unlike sonar. And similar techniques, PRF tunes into the actual atomic signature of a target, and there is no method known by which PRF can be jammed. By deploying their navy to the Arabian Sea, the Russians are pretending to be fooled by the Bolshevik distraction with the aircraft carriers. In this way, they encourage the Bolsheviks to launch the subcraft toward their targets. They waited until the subcraft were far away from their bases and out of sight of the Bolsheviks, who are directing the American first strike operation. But the whole time, they were being tracked by Cosmospheres overhead, using PRF. And shortly after 1 a.m. yesterday morning, Eastern Standard Time, the Cosmospheres began firing their charged particle beam weapons. There were 10 subcraft in the White Sea. Each disappeared in a blinding blue-white waterspout of steam, smoke, and fire. In the north end of the Caspian, there were 19 subcraft. They, too, met the same fate. In Audio Letter 33 for April 1978, I revealed that the United States no longer has spy satellites which can spy on Russia. By that time, Russia had already destroyed them all using their Cosmos interceptors. And so the Bolshevik war planners here in America were unable to observe the destruction of the subcraft. The subcraft had also been instructed to maintain strict radio silence, ironically, to escape detection. So their total silence now has aroused no suspicions on the part of the Bolsheviks. At this moment, the Russian Navy is still deployed in the Arabian Sea as before. They are still pretending to be misled by the Bolshevik ploy with the aircraft carriers. Because the subcraft contingents were only half of the first strike plan I described in Audio Letter 37. The other half is to involve the RPVs in Xinjiang Province, China. When Synthetic Defense Secretary Harold Brown went to China earlier this month, agreement was reached to allow American RPVs into Xinjiang Province. They are on their way there now and are due to be set up for attack at the earliest possible moment. The Bolsheviks here in America believe their subcraft are now waiting at their final checkpoints for the order to attack the Cosmodromes. They intend to give that order as soon as the RPVs are in place in Xinjiang Province. But the Russians intend to ruin the plan. Presently stationed along Russia's border with Xinjiang Province are four special Russian commando detachments. They are an elite corps, highly trained and armed, with battlefield nuclear weapons. They are there to attack and destroy the RPVs upon arrival before they can be fired. As a backup, there are also 18 Cosmospheres overhead, but those will not be used unless it becomes absolutely necessary. The Russians are saving their most powerful weapons for the big war to come, for maximum surprise. Right now, they regard what they are doing as an operation to begin pulling the fangs of the Bolshevik dragon. They use Cosmospheres to destroy the subcraft because their enemies were unable to observe it and learn anything. But there will be witnesses, even if they say nothing publicly, in Xinjiang Province. The coming operation against Xinjiang Province is essential to the Russians, and so the operation is under the command of a top member of the new ruling group of Kremlin hardliners. He is Viktor Paputin, an engineer and formerly second in command of Russia's National Police. Early this month, on January 3, the day before the Harold Brown synthetic left for China, Pravda carried an announcement about Paputin. It reported his untimely death, quote unquote. But this was only a cover story to explain his sudden absence from Moscow. He was actually on his way to the Chinese border to be one step ahead of the Bolshevik first strike plan. My friends, the decade of the 80s is starting off as a decade of mortal danger. But if the tempo of events continues at this rate, the danger will not last very far into the decade. One way or another, it will all be over soon. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.